Tom Killingbeck is one of those fortunate people who makes a living doing what he loves. As the Canadian mining sector lead and principal scientist for Arcadis Canada, Tom travels from his home in Ontario to destinations near and far to devise, construct, and help maintain continuous monitoring installations of all sorts. His clients, largely in the mining and industrial sectors, rely on him to keep them in regulatory compliance and improve operations. And because many are in far-flung locations, he chooses his instrumentation carefully, putting it through what he calls the test of Tom before it ever goes into an installation. With more than 25 years in the field, he's seen it all. And as he brings advancements in continuous monitoring solutions to his clients, he's giving them the opportunity to collect real-time data they've never before had access to. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Aquapod, where we share water monitoring stories from the field. I'm Helen Taylor, content manager with InSitu.
And I'm Adam Hobson, application development manager with InSitu.
And our guests today are Tom Killingbeck and Chris Howard. Tom is the Canadian mining sector lead and the principal scientist for Arcadis Canada. And Chris is our own award-winning regional sales manager for all of California. Tom has worked in the mining sector, providing environmental and managerial support to many mine closure and mine reclamation projects across Canada. He routinely develops instrumentation solutions to support groundwater and surface water monitoring programs. An expert in real-time monitoring equipment, Tom often works in remote locations reliant on cellular and satellite communications for data transmission, and he frequently includes in situ equipment in his installations. He and Chris Howard have worked together on several projects, so we thought it would be great to have Chris join the conversation. Tom, Chris, welcome to Aquapod.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for having us.
You bet. It's great to have you here.
Hey, Tom and Chris. Good to see you guys. Thanks for being with us today. Tom, you and I have worked together for many years now, and actually Chris and I have also worked together for many years, and all three of us have had some good adventures together on working on various innovative projects. You want to hear a little more about kind of some of your experiences here. What are some stories you've got here? I know you've kind of working across, you know, mining and industrial sites and even things like, I mean, even just to like working with aquaculture and kind of fish farming a little bit. So want to start off there, kind of maybe some stories that you've had with where it's been successful for you.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. I could start maybe with one of the industrial projects that I'm working on. So I've got an industrial client that's got a groundwater plume, sadly, that's discharging into a local creek and water body. And, you know, and I've had that problem for quite a long time, and they've been doing the required regulatory sampling for that. So a few years ago, we put in when the viewings come out, right? So also now the price, this is more of a bit of a public area. So, you know, for a tripod and a solar panel, you know, the theft and vandalism would have been huge, but the viewlink, I can hide that right inside of the monitoring well. Also, when the viewlinks came out, we put a viewlink in some 8500s for chemistry in a well, in a monitoring well that's 10 feet from that adjacent creek and where we know the plume was discharging. And then we're running pH and conductivity there for the indicators of that leachate. So as we got the equipment installed, we noticed that during rain events, this creek comes up 6 or 7 feet in a day or overnight. Absolutely amazing. Feet.
That's a lot.
So much so that I had one of the local guys go down and try to read my staff gauge that he sent me a picture, which I could not see it any longer on a 5-foot staff gauge run. So, you know, then you start looking at the data from that and go, you know, when that creek's coming up that high, what's it doing to the groundwater? So I could physically see as that water came up in the creek, it pushed that cleaner surface water into the aquifer, actually changed the gradient and pushed that leachate plume backwards. It stopped the leachate from discharging. So because this creek is part of the surface water control structure for this industrial client, and they do have, you know, two or three sort of water control features there, we're talking to them now about maybe just downstream of here, putting in a couple of stop logs, raising that water up, right? We got depth. I got them surveyed in. I could tell you, you know, within a quarter of an inch, you know, what that level is that leachate stops discharging. Push it back and then put a couple of extraction wells in that area and, you know, get that leachate, pump it to the treatment plant, and stop it discharging to the environment. So data we would have never seen, right? We would never send people out in the field when a river's coming up 6 or 7 feet to have them collect samples, right? It'd be too dangerous. They had been doing the sampling there, but it's, on a every 3 month cycle. So you go out on a nice sunny day every 3 months and collect those samples. But now that we have this data running on 10 minute time series, it lets us see one, how far the water comes up, how it changes that chemistry, and then at what level when that river comes down, does that leachate start passing that well again and going back to the creek? So that's information we would have never got without the real-time instrumentation there.
That's amazing. And again, as you said, it's not like they weren't monitoring before. They were doing what they thought was probably best practices, correct?
Well, they were doing the best practice or what the government regulatory agencies, were demanding them to do, right? So we all work in that, right? So if you've got contaminants every, sometimes it's monthly sampling, every third month, weekly, these guys, I want to say we're on a 3 month cycle there. This site's a little different where this creek is part of their water management, right? So that allows us to have some options where I can dam it up and back it up without going through the entire permitting process, right? They're already doing that at a couple of spots here. But it could stop a pretty major leachate contamination from this river that does, run to the environment. So, they've been working and spending quite a bit of money to build an engineered cover to try to stop the input of groundwater, right? Water into the groundwater to push it out, and that's helping. But now the finesse is I can really, I think, put a couple extraction wells here and grab the rest of that leachate and send it to the treatment plant. So that'll be extremely helpful to the client.
Right.
Bob, I remember you calling me after that rain event and seeing the river rise and us jumping on HydroView and you showing me this and how excited the client was when you showed it to them.
Yeah, so we're lucky here that the client's an engineer and she actually used to work with us at Arcadis at one point and now works for the client, right? So she understands. And when none of us believed it, right? So I've been doing this 25 years. You don't see data like this. This is the first time I've ever seen something like that. And then to go out and stand there and go, hey, this is bringing it up, look at it. Here's how the water collects, with her and we could put a couple extraction wells here. After they had been doing 10, 12, 15 years of monitoring to finally see that, right? The client loves that. And listen, that client, as has bought some systems now on some of their other sites also, and they love the HydroView. We're using it for notifications for them for triggers, right? If the water gets too high or the chemistry gets too bad, and they've bought in across the board and they love it.
That's fantastic. Why do you think, Tom, it is that, again, there's plenty of other options out there for telemetry systems. Telemetry is not new, certainly, and you certainly know that very well. Why do you think this one works so well for them?
Well, some of it is that I can hide it in the wellhead, right? So listen, I sell equipment from all different suppliers. That's what's best suited for the project, right? What's the price point of the project? What are the government regulators looking for? What's the level of vandalism? And here it was the vandalism, right? Some people come down here, there's a path, a walking path along the river, all those things. With the view links where I could hide it inside of the protective cover of the monitoring well and lock it. When we could run it inside of an armored liquitite conduit and bury it, so then no one knows it's there, it's well hidden. No one knows that site and that instrumentation is even there. Where if I would have set up a tripod with a solar panel, right, some little kid would have beat that solar panel with his hockey stick, right? And it wouldn't be working. So having that option with the ViewLinks with the 3D batteries where I can not need the secondary power from the solar panels and stuff has really opened up some other opportunities for me and opportunities for clients. And the price point, price point on the ViewLink is second to none for what's out there for communication devices in this industry.
That's great to hear. That's good to know. And seems like, again, this has led to other opportunities, you may have with this, not only with this client, but potentially in other projects as well.
Yeah. Like when we're rolling out the ViewLinks, you know, so, you know, you showed it to me long before it was on the market. I remember you and I meeting at a conference and you pulling it out from under the desk there. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's, and I beta tested those for you guys and tried to work with, you know, your team to make it field ready, right? Like when I get something and go in the field, you know, I'm very disciplined that I test and build those things at home in my home office and shop first. So I can make sure, you know, the, and I'll pass that along to all people doing this. Like, set up the hydro view ahead of time, set up the equipment, set up the time series, set up the triggers and alarms. Like, I always have gear running here and buckets, and my wife laughs and are outside where, you know, I'm testing it well ahead of time before we ever go for deployment. It makes it easier in the field, lets the client sort out the hydro view that they could log on, lets me set it up with the dashboard the way they want to see it. How do they need the data? So when I'm in the field, I go, hey, it's running. And they go, well, you've only been here an hour and I can see the data live, right? So they like that. It's smoke and mirrors a little bit, but the clients like that.
Right. Well, again, no one always sees the work that happens behind the scenes.
Correct.
Before you get out there. But Tom, it's an interesting point, though, that you make, though, about there. You know, I think that what we're seeing here is that there is equipment out there that certainly is very easy to use. But it sounds like, you know, the kind of, you are certainly doing something kind of ahead of time to make sure that you're going to be successful with the instrumentation. And tell me just a little more about kind of what your process is there for kind of not only with in situ equipment, but potentially with other equipment, kind of your pre game plan, if you will.
Yeah. So usually a client would call me and go, here's the problem I have. And then you got some ideas. And then I would call Chris and go, hey, they want to do this, you know, and Chris and I talked that through and go, you know, a 500 would be good with a view link, or we're using a Mace box with a weather station, right? What are we going to use for this deployment? And then I put costing together then for the client, obviously, right? They approve that costing and then everything gets shipped directly to me. And I set it all up here at home. That's weather stations. I set it up outside. Like I said, then I go through to set up the hydro view. I set up the logins, let the client log in and see that data running live, right? Different clients want to see different things. Do they need it in Excel? Can they just want a dashboard? Do they want a hydrograph? So I sort of walk through all those bugs, which is easy for me to do in an office setting, but hard to do in the field during deployments, right? And a lot of the times those are settings I need the client to tell me exactly what they want so I can set up that equipment for them in the field. It's no good for me to get home and try to set up the hydro view and they go, well, really, I wanted this and I got to drive, you know, 8-10 hours to the site, right? I've got this gear that's, you know, and Chris and I always laugh. I had to go back and change a cable once and I sent him a video. It's a 22-hour day and a boat ride and a portage and a truck and a four-wheeler, like, right? So it's not as simple as, you know, tell Tom to push the button and change the cable. Like, that's an all-day event. So just making sure everything is up and operational. Hey, sometimes you get a bad cable, right? Sometimes the batteries we get, you know, aren't holding charge. Test all that here at home. So when I'm in the field doing the deployments, they go off simple. And the guys and the, you know, site supervisors for that specific site, I'm on site and disrupting them as little as possible, right? Mm. A lot of these sites I'm working on are active mine sites, they're active industrial sites. I really am a pain to those guys to be on site. They may have to shut an area down, stop production. I want that to be as quick and efficient as possible. And doing that stuff ahead of time really lets me be efficient in the field for them also.
And I love that. I actually learned that from Tom. You know, and I share that with all of our customers now. Hey, set everything up before you take out in the field. Make sure things happen. We might, you know, we might get a nick in a cable or something, you know, in shipping, or, you know, FedEx buried it and smashed something, you know? So, you know, definitely make sure everything's working before you leave home and you have it up and running. It's a great tip.
Good advice.
Or if it has software or firmware updates, right? So, you know, those things happen. It's a lot easier to do when you have full, excellent connection here at home. Sometimes out in the field, we're running on 25, 30% maybe cell coverage, right? Where those updates take 90 minutes instead of 9 minutes. So like I said, just, and I preach this to anyone that'll listen, do those setups at home first and really get that instrumentation ready for field deployment. And clients are willing to pay that, right? So I would charge that to the client, whatever it is, 6 or 8 hours of prep time, they're seeing I'm doing things because now they're logging into the HydroView. They're seeing the data running live in a bucket of water. I move it up and down, whatever. I go, oh, yeah, I saw a change. Right. We're getting it field deployment ready, I call it.
That's excellent. I think excellent advice, and that's kind of good best practices there. Now, Tom, you, Chris, myself have kind of worked together on a kind of, you know, I said for many years now. We've also had some interesting projects that we've worked on. I know one that we did was really kind of involving a little more of an innovative idea of kind of putting together multiple dissolved oxygen sensors.
Yeah, that was a funny one. So we had a government regulator up here for a mining client up here in Northern Ontario that was worried that the water. So a hard rock mining, the number one contaminant is ammonia from blasting, right? It's residual from blasting. So when you're treating that water, it really makes an oxygen deficient discharge. So I had never seen this before. Like I said, I've been doing it 25 plus years, but right in, if these guys wanted a permit. And so it's a mine that's, you know, just getting in operations. They're actually just about to pour their first gold pour here next month. Right. So they're, I'm going to say 400 or 500 million into getting a mine up and running. And these guys, I know the guys are really good. They gave me a call and said, can you read this? So the government regulator wanted continuous dissolved oxygen profile monitoring at the three downstream lakes from their treatment plant. So, you know, I know most of the regulators up here, just right in my backyard, and I called this fellow and had a chat with him, and that's really what he wanted. He wanted, you know, from surface up 1 meter depth, 2 meter, 3 meter, to half a meter from the bottom, wanted to know the DO continuously every 10 minutes. I had a plan, a trip plan to come see you guys in Colorado, and we all got together and, you know, we just kind of walked through it. And I remember you and Chris and I laying it out across your boardroom floor, like, okay, we could use these DO sensors and, you know, this many splitters, and how many can we run off one view link, and, you know, and what's the buoy look like, how heavy does it have to be and how big, and, you know, we had to get a big enough buoy to keep the view link up out of the water, and how are we going to get the antennas out. But we really designed, the three of us designed that system in the boardroom there. And then, you know, I tweaked and tested it here at home first, as always. But, you know, we're just doing the reports from 2023 data from those DO strings right now. Government regulator, super happy. We got them deployed. We let them run. We get those in usually the end of April as ice goes out. And I pull them out sort of that first week in November up here before ice comes in. So I get a full ice season. The big thing we see there is on big storm events. So everyone thinks the lake turns once a year, right? It'll flip from temperature. I'm seeing during storm events, those lakes full turn and have consistent DO all the way across that profile of the lake. So once again, data you would never, ever get. We would never send anyone out in a thunderstorm, right, to measure DO profiles across the lake. It wouldn't be, you know, safe to do that, obviously, and it might get hit by lightning. But now that we have these sensors with the readings every 10 minutes during storm events, I'm seeing full lake turns and DO profiles change from these big thunderstorms that are rolling through there and the big wind events.
Just curious, does it end up then going back to being stratified?
It will, but it takes, depending on how much it turns, it might take a week, it might take a day, it might take 3 days. Like, we see it stratify back off.
Interesting.
So, you know, listen, you and I are been doing this for a while, and you know different than me, and usually we would expect 0% DO in that sort of 15 to 20 foot range, and all of a sudden I'm pushing, you know, that back to maybe 10 or 15% in summer events. So it really changes, and I pass that along, you know, to other people that work in our surface water here, and, you know, that's definitely something I should be sharing a little bit more at some conferences and stuff, because that is not how, you know, scientific experts like ourselves see those lakes. We assume when that profile runs out that it just turns once a year, and that's not what's happening off these profiles that I've got up and running for these three lakes here in Northern Ontario.
Right. Challenge your assumptions, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And this one, I mean, we did have a couple of things that, you know, we had to work out at the very beginning, but this project was of the some of the bigger projects we've worked on, Tom. This one went pretty smooth. But I think why why I enjoy working with Tom so much is that Tom's an out of the box thinker, and I like that. I like solving problems. Tom's like like solving problems. And, you know, just like you said, you know, we're laying this out on the conference room floor at Intuitu and came up with a solution. And, you know, Tom, I have many stories about Tom of being out of the box and creative on how he having projects that, you know, might not have the typical setup, but in the end, we come up with a solution and have been, you know, giving his clients some great data to look at.
Yeah, this was one of those where, you know, a couple of other consultants had took a shot at this and had some numbers for equipment prices that were astronomical, right? They were talking like floating buoys and stuff like we would use out in the ocean and things like that in some back lake. And I want to say that we were able to get something designed here for about 30% of their cost and installed. You know, here with the ViewLinks, I'm able to get a full season on one set of batteries. So we just go out in the spring and deploy them, right? We're getting that full 6 or 7 months and then pull them out in the fall. So, right, it's just an ice out type situation. And listen, no one's really done this, right? Like, I've never seen live continuous DO profiling in someone's permit. But now that I've done this, I presented and showed some of this data internally, and I know there's other Arcadis projects here that have the exactly same setup that we did on that boardroom floor, and they're using that as kind of a standard here for some projects and some mining and some in some ports where they're doing dredging projects and want to see how that's it's affecting. And I think some guys right now are going to put 2 or 3 zones down one to run chemistry live across the profile on a dredging job. So, you know, that outside the box thinking here has led us to have a different way to approach profiling surface water that we could have always done. You just have to think that way. Like, I really do have a lot of clients that call me when everyone else has failed and said, "Hey, Tom, what do you think?" And like Chris just said, like, you got to think outside the box. And it's, you know, that's how I got into this industry. So back in 98 or 99, when I had some pressure transducers in some wells and told people don't use the water. And then I go to take water levels and I can hear their toilet flushing and their dishwasher going. we really took some old analog bag phones like from in the vehicle and in my garage. And it was with the Solness guys way back when. And we soldered some parts together and made those two things communicate somehow so that we could start doing, you know, live data transmissions in 98, 99. And the Ontario government here bought a platform. We put in about 500 of those, but the original ones were on those analog bag phones. Wow. And compared to what we do now, right, it's day and night. So I've been doing it for a long, long time. I was definitely a little ahead of the curve, but I just never gave up. And, you know, today I really have become the go-to person for clients that have some problems that other consultants or, you know, have tried, or regulators got some weird one-off things, and I try to set them up in a real-time application for those things.
That's great. And Tom, I mean, that is kind of that's your main role with Arcadis, correct?
That's my full-time job here, finally. So, like I said, I just would never give up on it. I love it so much. It's my true passion, as you guys know. And, you know, from the mountains of Alaska, where the helicopters drop me off and pick you up in 8 hours if they can find you and the snow's coming sideways, you know, to what we're doing up across the Arctic. I've got lots of stations now across the Arctic, right, where it costs $50,000 to send humans there. You know, I could set up a station for $25,000, and some of these stations I have there, we're running full chemistry as it leaves these abandoned mine sites mm-hmm. out to the environment. So, you know, the government regulators love that. We put camera systems in now so we could take pictures of the tailings, right, year round. What's the erosion look like, right? What's the river look like during freshet pictures every day? So it's just like having humans there now with the real-time deployments we're doing. And, you know, cameras and stuff have been around a long time, but, you know, I could all of a sudden put a staff gauge there and take a picture, and I could see the turbidity in the water and see the depth of the water, and then run a, you know, what's the erosion model look like? So we're just using existing technology in different applications up there in the Arctic, and it's really saved here to the federal government, but it's saved them a lot of money that we don't have to send humans up there as often any longer.
Well, I think it sounds like that's a bit of a challenge there in terms of the, you know, not only do we want to not put people in harm's way, but I bet there's also some challenges actually getting staff to have staff to even get out there, correct?
Yeah, I'm one of the rare breeds that love to go there and sleep in a tent. And last time I was up there, a musk ox just walked right in front of me, and I thought someone wasn't afraid of me. I thought that was pretty cool. And
yeah,
you know, sometimes we get weathered in there for a week. That happens, right? It's been fogged in and snowed in, and snows in August, and all those things. So, but I love it, right? So, you're right. And whatever, everyone's piling on the younger generation, but I have a hard time with the younger generation to go, hey, we're going somewhere to sleep in a tent in the Arctic for 30 days, you know, and there's no comms and pack your sleeping bag, we leave tomorrow. They just look at me like I'm crazy. but for me, I love it. And it's, you know, I cut my teeth doing it, and I feel truly blessed to be out there and doing it still every day. I love it.
That's great.
Fantastic.
I don't know if it's just the younger generation, Tom. I've never volunteered on that trip with you either.
this is where Chris, Tom, and I differ a little bit. Tom and I are more of that ilk of getting out there and doing it. Chris is like, I'll hang out.
Let me know how it goes.
Yeah, you got to call me when you're back. That'll be good.
That's true. Chris is the guy I call once I got it up and running so he can check online to make sure he can see it.
From the comfort of his couch.
Yeah, from the comfort. We've all got our different role here.
We always need those people. That's absolutely. Tom, you've had some, you know, obviously, you know, going to like really remote areas and that sort of thing, but you've also had some interesting stuff just with some, I guess, somewhat more controlled environments, but kind of some interesting applications. I believe you had basically a project around kind of raising fish with an aquaculture project.
So this is a good one. That's for Valet. So Valet, let me share and give them a plug here, right? So here locally in Sudbury, they raise thousands of fish that we have fish release every year, like back in the lakes and stuff as part of their re-green program here in the Sudbury area. When my kids were little, you'd go out on the Sunday and they'd give you a few fish in a bucket and you go to wherever you're going to release them. Like, it's a real community event that we do here. So, a good friend of mine runs that aquaculture pond now, and he was having a lot of problems with the fish dying, mortality in the fish. A lot of it was purely from human error. So that's how this started. And it's very close to my house. I live 20 minutes from there. So, it really started, believe it or not, when you guys gave me a couple of ViewLinks, the beta test, when the ViewLink was just going to come out. So I talked to Chris and go, yeah, you know, sure, I'll beta test one. I got the perfect project for this fish rearing pond. So we put it in, and they wanted quite a few chemical parameters. So we used a pair of AT600s, right, off a splitter. So that was all new to ViewLink. How are we going to split it? Can it run to AT600s? And the software guys and I and Chris worked together and got that deployed. And it worked.
Tom, to interrupt, just so we know that Aquatrol 600 is a five port SON. So you have four water quality sensors plus a wiper on that. So you had to run two of them, correct?
Yeah. So yeah, that's why we had to run a pair, because I needed seven parameters to come out of there is what they were looking for, right? So they're looking for chlorides, right? They're adding city water. How much chlorine are we adding back in? They're looking for ammonia, like from fish. Poop and pee and all the other stuff, right? Like, we're looking for that water quality DO, we're looking for levels, temperature, all the stuff. But we got it up and running. We set up the alarms and the triggers, the notifications through HydroView. You know, there's five of us that get a text, right? Every time there's a text, you know, we just instantly now we can go online on our phone and see, like, did someone just change the water and the water's starting to come back up? We're on a 5-minute time series there. And it's been great. They absolutely love it. They no more human error. A few times we have caught it. Once one of the pump fittings blew off and we were able to get there long before the tank was empty and rectify that problem to save the fish. So it's really been helpful. And it's close to my house. So like when you're beta testing, now listen, you guys know this, but when I beta test your gear, I rip it apart and make it fail, right? Like if I'm bringing it to the Arctic, it's got to pass the test of Tom. And I always tell anyone I'm beta testing gear for, grow some thick skin, and it's not a personal attack, but I am going to try to break it and make it fail, right? So I can help you make it better. So it'll be better for me. And we did that with that ViewLink, as you guys know, like when the AT7 and 800s came out, right? This is a perfect spot to beta test one of those. So beta tested one of the AT800s. Now, instead of needing two zones, I can put all those ports in one zone.
Right.
And we've actually upgraded that station now to just have the one 1800 instead of the two 8600s. And it's been better for the client. It's overall cheaper for the client. We run chemistry. We actually take hard samples out of that tank and we run that lab chemistry against those zones. No problems at all. They really do hold calibration and stuff for a long time. And then here's my, you know, for everyone else, you need to sell those with a brush, right? So in the fish tank, we get algae, we get slime. In my mining things, I get iron precipitate. But I can't believe any of those zones come without a brush. I would never deploy it in the field without the brush. If you do, you just watch. They just don't hold calibration. They get slimed over and the calibration just drifts away. When you got that brush on there, I've really had some in the field. After a year, I go and they're within 1 or 2% still a calibration, but they're clean, right? If the calibration is lost from them being dirty. So that's my sales pitch for the brush. I would never install one without a brush.
You know, it's a good point. Anti-fouling is it's a critical part. I think a lot of people overlook that. So I think it's good to hear your experience on that, particularly with the parameters that we're looking at, the environments we're dealing with. Having a brush, or you know, even if you get into saltwater environments, putting copper guards and other
things. All the stuff. Absolutely.
You have to do that. I couldn't agree more. It's always the first thing to think about.
I've enjoyed this client, Tom, too, is just their flexibility and shows, you know, Tom's relationship with them, but their flexibility of, hey, we've got a newer platform that's going to be better for you, and their openness to switching out to that newer platform, and Tom's being able to explain to them, say, hey, this is, in the end, this is going to save you guys money, and they keep expanding with us and wanting to try new things. We're actually working on doing some room temperature for them for this project as well. So, but they've been a great client, but just really shows Tom's relationship with his clients too. And when, you know, new products come out that are going to be innovative and help the client, their willingness to take that recommendation from Tom and go with it.
Chris is right. I'm very fortunate to have clients that are very trustworthy of me and open to use new instrumentation. But, you know, I've never steered them wrong. Like, I beta test a lot of gear. I test for a day, put back in the box and send back to some people and say, not a chance, right? So, you know, if my name's on it, there's a certain level of expertise and quality that I would expect. But here's something Chris doesn't know. So when I use any equipment for valet, I have to go for secondary inspection from a couple of IT wizards. So I have to bring it to their plant. These two guys tear it apart, make sure there's no chance of it detonating off explosives and all the other stuff that are available on a mine site. And that passed the valet inspection. They had all that gear for 2 or 3 days. And same when I brought the 8800 and stuff there, I had to bring it to the IT guys for pass. And it gets a gold sticker, and you can't use any equipment on a valet site without passing that with that sticker. So kudos to you guys. It, you know, you guys didn't know that was happening behind the scenes, but it did pass their level. And a lot of gear doesn't, just, you know, like that, the shockproof type things and stuff, especially when we're running off the lithium ion batteries there, right? The 3-volt one. So we got 3 batteries in there. That could be a trigger point, definitely. And it passed all their tests on that level also. So kudos to you guys for that.
That's fantastic to hear. Thanks for sharing that.
Tom, how'd you get started in this line of work? Tell us a little bit about your background.
So I started working for a water pump company when I was 13 years of age and was doing hydrogee studies where I manned the pumps and the generators at 15. So because I wasn't old enough to drive, they dropped me off with my tent and the generator, and I would do pumping tests for subdivisions at a young age. I don't know if that's allowed anymore, but back then it was fine.
Yeah, I think that's child labor. So,
yeah, I want to say they paid me about $2.30 an hour back then, and I was grateful to get it. It was more money than delivering papers, so it found a good. But I was the guy running around to take all the water levels, right? So you do one of these hydrogee studies. There's one pumping well and 10 monitoring wells. And back then you had a clipboard beside each well, and you physically ran around and measured a water level and wrote it down. That's how we monitor. And I'm like, this is crazy. There's got to be something better than this. So Van Essen back then was one of the few people with Solness that had some pressure transducers. So I started using some of those and getting them in. So now I didn't have to run around. I could just upload the data, you know, every couple hours to make sure it's working. And then a big municipal one happened where there was some private home residences that we had to get a static water level when they weren't using the water, which was just not possible. Like anytime I went there, they were using the water. Yeah, so with the Solness guys, we built some 3-button controller to an analog bag cell phone from your truck. That was the only cellular communications back then. And we set them up in these wells and they worked. And we were able then to get that data for that Hydro G study. I remember it was a ski hill is there now, but it was, you know, for the ski chalet and stuff, this Hydro G study. But we were able to utilize that to transfer that data. And then from that turned into what became the Provincial Groundwater Monitoring Network up here in Ontario. I built that. I always loved it. And any problem that someone else couldn't solve, I wanted to solve it. And, you know, then we went to tripods and solar panels and deep submarine batteries, the power stuff, right? And satellite comms to what we have now with the ViewLink, where it runs off 3D batteries and you track height of the way in the monitoring well. Like, that's amazing for me to watch. Things change and the industry get better and the Bluetooth comms and all the stuff. And then for me, it's become so user friendly that on occasion I can get my clients on site to do some of the work, right? So they would have no knowledge of instrumentation, but they could maybe go there and upload the data through the Bluetooth comm if I give them the VuesitU app, right? Or maybe run an update if it needs an update, where instead of me driving for 8 or 10 hours, I know I recently have one of my clients that's about 5 hours away. Got a younger guy I know up there and have worked with him quite a bit, and you know, had him download the app, and with some instruction over the phone, he was able to go out and update his 5 stations, right, of the update that it needed. So, you know, I find your gear very user-friendly. Got lots of equipment that, you know, the client would never be able to touch, right? It runs off old MS-DOS software. We're hard jamming commands into it and stuff. But, you know, someone with limited knowledge was able to get that one up and running and get those updates done. So that was, I find the HydroView clients like easy, it's point and shoot, right? So I deal with lots of dashboards. I find that one very easy for me to set up and for clients to use. And we can get the data out into Excel for reporting. Kudos to you guys. And with the VuesitU app and the Bluetooth connection to the ViewLink, same thing, very user-friendly.
Do you think that continuous monitoring is the standard now, would you say?
Well, up here in Canada, I had to actually talk to some of the regulators. And because I was really one of the few people doing it up here, some of the times they would email the mining clients, you know, call Tom and buy his equipment. And I kind of laughed and I go, no, it's called continuous monitoring. but I'm seeing like the government agencies are getting smart, right? They would really like to see that. You can't hide anything in a continuous monitoring situation, especially if it's a river where it's discharging from a mine site and I'm running live chemistry, right? If I'm only sampling once a week, well, I'm not sampling if the water looks like scope mouthwash, right? It's, you know, I'm not filling the bottle there, obviously. So, the government agencies really like it, and it will be mandatory if it's not already for a lot of locations here in Canada. And I'm starting to see that in the States, right? The industrial clients I got there are moving to the continuous monitoring because they're getting pressure from the government agencies also.
I think what we found too with, you know, with COVID and people not being able to get on site that needed to have that information, not only that they can have access to this, but kind of like what we alluded to earlier with that riverbed coming up 7 feet, you're never going to get that important data unless you have continuous monitoring going. And if you can't see that and you can't send somebody out to get it, then, you know, you're not capturing an event that's happening and what the effects are going to be. So I know the state of California has been very proactive and they are definitely moving in that direction of getting everything with continuous monitoring.
And absolutely. Adam, I'm assuming you're seeing that too on the projects you're working on.
Absolutely. No, I think continuous monitoring is really becoming the standard. In fact, I when working with any customer or having any conversation about it, that's one of the first questions I ask is why? Why wouldn't you want continuous monitoring data? And bringing up these examples of what are you missing is a critical part to this. I think as we look more and more into hydrologic systems, I think we understand that you know they don't fit into nice neat boxes, like sometimes we assume. If you're not seeing those things, whether it's, you know, lakes overturning in storms or, you know, changing hydraulic gradients in surface water, groundwater interactions, or, you know, just stage measurements, we need to see that, because this is becoming it's becoming more of an issue. There's more people obviously that we have on this planet, and, we got to start dealing with with these hydrologic impacts. Our climate obviously is changing. We need to capture those changes and see if there's things that we can do to be more resilient to them. As Chris brought up, in California, they're doing some really extraordinary work on that in terms of trying to at least get a handle on their groundwater issues, which is commendable. But we, you know, I think now with the instrumentation being brought, I think becoming certainly a lot more available, we can spread that around the world, to be honest. It shouldn't be a barrier to collecting continuous data. Tom, you brought up that idea of back when, you know, you first started out, the stuff was kind of hard to get and it was hard to work with.
Well, and the price points, right? Like, so yeah. if when I started doing this, really my only clients were government agencies, right? Because they were the only one that could afford it. It was $25,000, $40,000 per setup and deployment. So, you know, unless you had some deep pockets, you know, Water Survey of Canada, those kinds of guys, they were the only ones doing it because they were the only ones that could afford it, right?
Right.
Now, like, I'm really like a ViewLink with an RT200 for some water levels, I don't know what I'm into, for $1,200 or $1,300. Like, that's peanuts. So, because the price point is so much better, it's not such a detriment to the clients. And you can show them, like, I run it all the time. I go, if you send two humans, because you have to send two for health and safety out on a mine site, if you send them out twice, you paid more than you paid for this equipment, mm-hmm. right? So the payback is 1.5 visits is what they're calculating up here. So, mine sites are usually out in the bush, and you know there's bears, and you know they're hard to get to, and you're walking over blast rock. So, and COVID, all of a sudden, no one was allowed to go on site. Nothing was better for me for this industry than COVID.
Right.
Hey, bear.
Yeah, hey,
bear. It was great.
Yeah.
So, you know, clients have realized that the price point is good, the data is great. We're seeing things we would never have seen in a manual data collection scenario, and it's an easy buy-in. It really is an easy buy-in, I find, to clients right now.
Tom, this has been a terrific conversation. Thank you for sharing your expertise and really giving us some great food for thought, especially when it comes to remote monitoring and the power of the technology that's available today. It's really been interesting to hear. Chris, thank you so much for joining in as well. Good to have your perspective on this. Yeah, we are going to enjoy sharing this out, and we wish you well in your future adventures with bears and otherwise. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
This is Aquapod, brought to you by Insitu. You can find more episodes and subscribe to the podcast on our website, insitu.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please listen, share, and help us spread the word. This episode was produced by Helen Taylor and Adam Hobson, with a big assist from Josiah Homeland and I25 Productions. We look forward to bringing you more water monitoring stories from the field. Until then, take care out there.